I'm Shannon Griffin, and this is Chatterbox. In the third of four episodes for my interview with Heather Mills, I find out why she became vegan, her experience of being in hospital herself, and her approach to dealing with challenges and adversity.
Take me back to the point where you decided that you were going to become a vegan. What was it that prompted that to happen?
Well, that was accidental as well. So when I came back from the war in the former Yugoslavia, which happened to be the place that I'd gone on holiday with the ex-wives and the kids, the stepkids, and then the war broke out. So I ended up going back and helping after I'd left the first husband. I came back to England and crossed the street and a police motorcycle chopped my leg off, crushed my pelvis, punctured my lung, and it was going to a false alarm, apparently, at Princess Diana's house. It was quite bizarre because I'd just come back from doing landmine work, and this is years before we got involved. So I came back to England, bizarrely, after working on the front line for 4 years, and across the street, and that accident happened, went to hospital, was in hospital for 5 months. Pelvis was the worst damage. Leg, yes, lost the leg, but infection was an issue. But the pain of the worst was actually the crushed pelvis. But my leg wouldn't heal, so they kept chopping it more and more. My girlfriend came in and said, I've cured myself of breast cancer. You've got to go to Hippocrates in America and become vegan. Now, I'm a Geordie, as if you hadn't worked that out by now. And I was brought up on sausage and mash, and sausage if we were lucky. But I actually realized we were vegan 5 days a week because we didn't have any money. So we were living off bean pie and a few potatoes and veg and things. So I was actually quite lucky, I realise now. Even though at school everyone had their ham sandwich and I used to envy it, thinking, oh, we've just got margarine in our bread. Now I'm happy about that, but not then. And she said, you've been in here 5 months, you're not healing, they're chopping your leg more and more, just give it a chance. So she took me out and took me to Hippocrates in West Palm Beach, put me on this disgusting thing called wheatgrass juice and colonics and all sorts of sprouted foods. And I healed within 2 weeks. So I came back, and because I was being followed by the media way back before my second marriage, they were asking, how did you leave here in such a state and come back completely healed? And that's how I discovered veganism. So I was raw vegan for 2 years, which was very important if you have the digestive enzymes to break down raw food, which in my 20s I did before I got Lyme's disease, and then they were ruined, but that's another story. And then I wrote books on it, and going back to freezing cold England, it was hard to stay raw vegan. So I started to develop and make replications of what I used to like. So I used to love sausage and mash, so I made vegan sausage and mash. And that's how I started developing vegan alternate products in the early 90s, when I did the first McDonald's burger, then the Burger King type vegan burger and vegan cheese and fish-free alternates and all the things I missed. And it's how I made it very easy for my child to grow up 20 years vegan, because I could just create a hot dog or create a vegan cake. And now I teach Michelin chefs how to change their menu to vegan, because it's quite astonishing how little so many chefs know and how simple it is. You don't have to say the word vegan. You just eliminate the nasties out of it and it tastes great.
About the experience that you had in hospital, obviously as hospital radio, we interact with patients on a daily basis, going, doing ward rounds, collecting requests. And it strikes me that being in hospital is not an easy thing. We take for granted the fact that they're there. But how did you cope for all those months in hospital? And what advice would you give to anybody who's in hospital and struggling with their time there?
Keep busy, learn a language, read all the books that you never could before, and stop focusing on where you are and just shut your head out. It's a bit like if I'm stuck on an aeroplane for 12 hours, everyone's going, oh God, panic. All I do is go, okay, great. Maximize this time, utilize it, pretend I could be sitting in my office, I could be lying in the bath, I could be anywhere. Get on and do something, get on and learn something. Knowing I had to be in there for a long time, quite a few months more than they thought, because the infection kept coming back. I did sneaky things. I'm not saying you should do this. Like, I'm not saying you should ever play truant from school as I did. But I would climb out the window, wrap my leg up in a bandage and get my boyfriend at the time to take me to La Boheme or one of the operas and then sneak me back through the
really?
Hospital window. Yes, because I wasn't actually allowed to leave back in the 90s. I think it's a bit different now, but they're like, no, you're here and that's it. Mm-hmm. So not recommending that necessarily, but literally having a perspective on life that whatever you're going through, we only have the here and now. None of us know if we're going to be here tomorrow. And if you focus on whether you've got 1 month, 1 year, 10 years, 20 years, you don't know. You know, I've literally nearly died four times. I shouldn't really be here. Everything that could happen has happened. And for some reason, with a positive attitude, I've managed to overcome things that have been told are not necessarily going to be able to overcome.
Do you think you have a bit of a rebellious streak?
100%. 100%. If someone says you can't do that, I will show that you can.
Yeah.
Because there is no such thing as you can't do something. I mean, it's why I ended up doing extreme world records when I was 47. Mm. And it was literally because I was stuck in the mountains in Austria and the Icelandic volcano went off and we couldn't get home. So I learned to ski properly and met with the Austrian ski team and they taught me how to ski and said, actually, you're really fast. Why don't you go on the British Paralympic team? I said, very funny. I'm 47. They're not going to take me on the team. Actually, I was 42 at the time. When I got the world records, I was 47. They said, no, you're too old. So I got a wild card, went to New Zealand, won a silver medal, and then got put on the team. So where you just get a no, ignore the no. Unless you're going to harm someone or do something bad, I'm not recommending that. But don't ever take no as a no, unless it's in a harmful situation, obviously. But just because somebody says no, some people say no, they don't even know why they're saying no. So, I mean, if you think about it, in modeling, this was what was funny. After I did the Mirror Dream Girl competition, this is a perfect example of not accepting a no, got a phone call from one of the girls. Who basically we'd been put in this Miss Cinzano competition and I came last. Well, I came first in the regionals and I came last in the final because they put us on stage with Wayne Sleep, the ballet dancer, who's about that wide. And they covered me in these stripy blue and white Cinzano going across stripes, which lengthens you on TV. So I didn't get anywhere. And then the girl said, oh, we've all been invited to interview for this Trillion Pictures rock and roll show as a presenter. I was like, oh, when's that? She said, well, we got the letter. Didn't you get the letter? I said, no. So I rang up Trillion Pictures, this man called Philip Goodhand Tate, and I said, excuse me. I said, I haven't had a letter. And he said, well, if you haven't, then you're not invited for the casting. And I thought, no way, absolutely not. So I asked my friend where it was at. And I bought a pizza and pretended I was a pizza delivery person. Managed to get in the building, which was round the back of H&M and the bus place in the back of Oxford Circus, and waited till everybody had left and then went up with a pizza, knowing they'd done all the casting. And I went around quickly and this gentleman looked out of his office and said, can I help you? And he happened to be the owner of Trillion Pictures, Philip Goodhand Tate. And I said, yeah, would you like a pizza? And he said, has anyone ordered a pizza to round the office? And I said, no one's ordered it. I just thought I'd bring it up because I wanted to talk to you to find out if I can cast, because I think a mistake was made because the letter didn't come to me. And he just liked my tenacity and said, okay, I can't promise anything. And I got the job out of 150 people because I didn't accept that I just hadn't had the letter. And I followed it through and we've stayed great friends ever since. And he actually rented me one of his offices in St. Vincent Street for half price when I wanted to set up my first model agency when I was 19. So if you want something, just keep going and going and going and going and you will get it. Just depends how much you want it.
And don't say no to Heather Mills because she'll find a way around it.
I'll find you.
Oh my gosh, I'll stalk you and find you. Heather Mills, take me back to your first engagement in humanitarian work, which has forged such an important part of your life.
I suppose knowing what people had gone through when I was a child, I was always trying to help people. That sort of became innate. And I suppose that comes from my childhood of being put through different challenging times. And then it was when I went on holiday with the husband at the time's ex-wife to the former Yugoslavia, mm-hmm. I basically saw that life was horrific. I mean, I went on the holiday the first time and then I loved it so much, I went back the second time to learn to ski properly. And then the war broke out. And I had a lot of people that I'd made friends with. So I drove them over the borders of Podkoren from Ljubljana into Austria and over to Klagenfurt and brought them back to England. At the time, when I came back to advise the Shadow Defence Secretary, David Clark, because he was the only one that would respond to my calls and letters and faxes, because I inundated him. And I said, if you don't get in there now and do something, there's going to be huge massacres. But unfortunately, because there's no gas or oil for the big countries to take, they have no interest in helping countries that can't give them something that they get something back for.
Yeah,
it's always about money. Don't ever think wars are about that Britain or America help or about humanitarianism. They're not. They're about, can we sell them weapons? Can we take their oil? Can we take their gas? We have terrorism because of what we've done to those countries. Mm-hmm. And terrorism is not right in any situation whatsoever. But having worked in Iraq and, you know, loads of different war zone countries, I know why we are so hated as a nation and why there's so much anger to us, because we brought that upon ourselves. And I don't mean we, I mean the powers that be.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I saw a lot of that working over there, and I basically set up a refugee crisis centre at Adria Airways, which was the airline in Conduit Street, just off Oxford Street and Regent Street in London. Got loads of the refugees jobs. They were sleeping on the floor all over my house. They're still great friends to these days. And then they were around for about a year, and then we took them back to former Yugoslavia and started setting up help areas, and it just escalated. It was absolutely horrific. And so I saw how atrocious it was that United Nations could only stand there and watch what was going on. And yeah, so I ended up very involved, and I still had two legs at the time. It wasn't until I came back to advise the Shadow Defence Secretary that I lost my leg crossing the street. So when people say, oh my God, you worked in so many war zones, or when I see people worry about, oh, I can't cross the street because of this, or I can't, when you're going to go, you're going to go. You know, I've nearly died four times. And when your time is up, your time is up. As far as fate, obviously you can lengthen your life with health and this and that, but other things can happen. So I could see that I could create solutions by not being afraid to knock doors down.
Yeah.
And I just got more and more and more involved. So I set up a charity, and then I aligned that many, many years later with the United Nations, who wanted to do mine clearance. And that's how I got involved with the American governments and Colin Powell and Hillary Clinton and General Wesley Clark and all these different people, just to show that there were very simple solutions to these issues.
And what you have accomplished, particularly with the landmine clearance, is quite extraordinary. Have you ever considered going into politics? Because it seems that you've got lots of good ideas, you've got lots of experience, you know, around the world. You could make a real difference. Does politics interest you?
I've been asked loads of times, to be honest, over the last 30 years to become an MP. But having analysed politics, unless we have a revolution, politics doesn't work. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't create anything. You'll get one phenomenal prime minister every 50 years or something. But the way that the system works, as I said before, I mean, I literally have spent so much time in Parliament just trying to get things put through, and I've changed lots of laws in the EU and the UK. And the best way to do it is to be on the outside,
yeah.
given them the solutions, because when you're on the inside, they can use you as leverage. So they can say, okay, Heather, I want you to vote for this and I'll vote for your bill. And then people are ending up voting for bills they don't even believe in just so someone votes for theirs. So it becomes like a bidding war, which is completely wrong. What needs to happen is there needs to be a complete reset that more than just the politicians have the voting right about what goes on. And I don't mean in the Brexit situation, because that was a disaster because there was consumer duping, there was misinformation. But I mean, there needs to be a broader team of people that basically just could be the common sense party, because there's not enough of that in there. The amount of time and energy and old-fashioned schoolboy childhood politics going on. Imagine instead of them ranting at each other about what's right and what's not, if they actually just got on and did it. It's a bit like people who sit and rant at the television. I'm like, what are you doing?
Turn it off.
Why don't you just turn it off and go and do something? So, and I think the thing with me is I wouldn't be everyone's cup of tea. I would be people's cup of tea that want to see change and want to see it quickly, because I know exactly what the solutions are, how they need to be implemented. I see it very clearly, and I've worked in so many areas. You know, when I worked on the TV show City Hospital many, many years ago with Esther Anson, I lived and breathed 24 hours in the Southampton Hospital, the first one, before we moved to London. So, and I was like, hang on a second, why are this middle management not listening to the nurses? And why are the doctors not respecting the nurses? And why is this? And what about all this waste? And there was so much waste. I remember when I was collecting machinery for the Gujarat earthquake, and the hospitals had started closing down locally everywhere. And I said, I kind of get that in one way, but it was the most stupid thing ever, the way they operated it, because they were disincentivized for saving money. So if they were given a budget, then they would want new equipment. And I picked up £500,000 worth of nearly new equipment for charity, because they were given a budget, and if they didn't spend it, the budget was reduced.
Yes, yes.
And what you have to do is you increase the budget when people spend wisely and efficiently. If they show a saving, you incentivize them with more money. You don't say, oh, we gave you six, you spent five, you're only going to get five next year. They've worked their asses off to save.
Yeah.
So you have to incentivize the team to not waste too much on PPE. All of those pennies can end up saving lives, creating more beds, running efficiently, and incentivizing staff that if they save money, they're going to get more. It's so obvious. And it's like, and this is why I couldn't go into politics, because I would end up banging my head against the wall going, are you completely stupid? Like, I think I would end up being a dictator, which most people wouldn't like, because I would be like, right, this is the problem, this is the solution, get on with it. Mm. And I've had people that have been working with me for 30 years. And the reason we get on well was because I listen to them. I consider the ideas. A lot of them are good. I think of what will work. And then if they're good, I'll say, great, let's do that. If they're not, I'll say, great idea, but it actually won't work because X, Y, and Z, because I've already made that mistake before and learned from it.
Yeah.
But if you don't consider and then implement, nothing happens. And it takes years.
So you've got a louder voice outside the system than you would perhaps have within the system. And that makes you more effective. Now, that's interesting, because you are forthright, articulate, well-read. It seems to me that you research most of the things that you get involved in to a level that most people wouldn't bother. What are you like at home? Are you easy to live with?
Well, according to my partner, I'm the easiest girlfriend he's ever had. I met him on a train 5 years ago.
Tell me about that.
Well, I won't go into any detail other than I met him on a train and he's absolutely brilliant. But his parents basically always say to him, you know, don't let her go. She's so easygoing. Because I have to spend 20 hours a day, 6 days a week, guiding people what to do, creating solutions, creating problems. When I'm at home, all I do is say, what are we doing? I don't want to know where are we going? What are we doing? Yeah. I don't want to think about anything. Yeah. I'm like, happy to stay in, happy to cook, happy to go out, happy to go on holiday. I love sport, mm-hmm. as long as I get sport in a few days a week, which luckily he does. So the only thing I couldn't do is live with someone if there wasn't two bathrooms. Because I can't stand mess in a bathroom. Worst case scenario, two sinks. But the noises they make in the morning, the toothpaste mess, the hair down the plug hole, you know, all that kind of stuff. I just literally would put most men, not all, because you get messy women, but generally most typical men, I would like put them in their own bathroom and just lock the door and never go in it again. And then say, come out when you're all clean and tidy. But apart from that, very easygoing.
I'm definitely with you on the separate bathroom thing. I can't share a bathroom with anybody. That's kind of one of my written rules. But Heather, you are an inspirational person for a lot of people, particularly those, I guess, who are closest to you. Who inspires you?
A lot of people ask me that. Day-to-day people. Parents that are looking after severely disabled kids, mm-hmm. who have patience and kindness, people who give a lot of their time, not necessarily money, who don't have much. No celebrities, no famous people. You know, I've met them, got some good friends in that area, mainly not. You know, my partner always says to me, all your best mates are, you know, from your childhood and working class and I just good people. I only like to be around good people. I don't like nastiness. I get very affected by cruelty. I leave a table if people start gossiping. I cannot stand gossip. Mm. It's time wasting. It just makes the individual look terrible. It's as if they're talking about themselves.
Yeah.
So I find kind people inspiring. Kindness is such an incredible quality, and it's so easy to be nice, and it takes so much energy to be nasty.
And I think I've heard you say a comment in the past that some of the most generous people are those that don't actually have much themselves. I think you found this when you were homeless at one point.
1,000,000%. I mean, I've always been helped the most by people with the least. Even when I went out to India for the Gujarat earthquake, I literally just went with a rucksack of vegan protein bars thinking there's going to be nothing to eat. Mm. And I would go for 5 miles and it would be fine. And then there would be a couple of miles of devastation. And people were just literally sitting in the rubble of their house in 2001, this was, and coming out to give me a little bit of their rice. And that's all they had. They didn't know when they were going to get food again, but they were so happy that we were coming to help because I was setting up makeshift hospitals, which is where I was getting that machinery sent over to for the Lions Club. And they would just give you everything. And then you get these people that just cling on, really wealthy people that cling on to every penny. What do you want to do? Die on a tomb of notes? Mm. I get that you need security. You need to have financial safety nets if you can, mainly so you can help other people. Also, if there was a medical emergency and you were on a waiting list and it was life-saving, yes, all of those things. But nobody needs millions and billions of pounds, which is why all of my money has gone into charity or trying to change and help businesses and just keep growing and growing and growing them. Some fail, some don't, but just to keep trying and just keep trying to make a difference and living very normally. People are always shocked. You know, I don't fly around on private planes or in helicopters or, you know, anything like that whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, I take one or two holidays away a year if I'm lucky. Mm. I love the combination of when I've worked hard treating myself to something and feeling like I deserve it. Mm. And then also my partner, when we first started dating, I didn't want to bring him home for at least a year. So I used to meet him in a Premier Inn. And he was like, what are we doing in a Premier Inn? I said, I love Premier Inns. They're consistent. They've got a good TV. They've got nice sheets.
You're right.
Yeah, decent beds, a good breakfast. You can't take the Geordie out of me, I suppose. Yeah, I like the roller coaster and the combination of my life. I like to overcome adversity and find solutions to problems. You know, this year has been a real crisis year for a number of our businesses because of the energy prices, because of ingredients, because of also bad management of one of the businesses. But I'm turning that around and making the impossible possible. Mm-hmm. And I say the impossible because lazy management think everything is impossible, and making it work with the workers. And it sounds mad, but the real workers are the ones that are on my factory floor that are working their backsides off to try and make things happen. And I really don't like it when people are undervalued or underappreciated, mm-hmm. because we all have a role to play. Mm. You know, we wouldn't be able to have these companies if we didn't have what I call the real workers making it happen.
Yeah.
So I look at myself just as a working class girl trying to make a difference.
My thanks to Heather Mills. Join me in the final episode of my 4-part Chatterbox series, where I explore Heather's relationship with the press, find out what she had in common with Margaret Thatcher, and discover how she balances the relentless demands of the lifestyle she has chosen. And to listen to more episodes or find links to all of our programmes and videos, visit hospitalradiomedway.co.uk. I'm Shannon Griffin, and you've been listening to Chatterbox.